Thank you, Natasha, and thanks, Scott. My goodness, there's an enormous amount in there. It's wonderful. We're getting questions coming through, Scott, and I'd love to get through, you know, as many of these as we can. Thank you to our audience for staying with us. We had a little technical glitch there for a bit. Thankfully, we got past that, and I think, Scott, people will have been really enriched by this. It's just been wonderful. Thank you. Let's jump in, Scott, here. This has come through. Given, Scott, what you've described about the corrosive effect of screens and digital tribalism, how do we begin to retrieve attentiveness in this context? What are some of the steps back to attentiveness from the, like this, neurological chaos of distraction from distraction by distraction?
Wow. That's a wonderful question. It sounds like it's the kind of question I might have written to pose to myself.
Yeah, it says it, Scott Stevens.
I promise I didn't, though. It's just a brilliant question. Look, I think one of the things, I think the first step for me, as with most things, is to get our language right. Maybe it's time for us to stop talking about what it is that we're doing online as forms of connection. Because I don't think they're really forms of connection. We're using technologies in order to do very, very basic things. But as soon as we use really important terms, I think terms that are worth holding on to, like share, like follow, like connect, these are big human words that name really important human activities. As soon as we cede those words to the digital sphere, I think we begin convincing ourselves that what we're doing when we're doing things online is a real thing. Look, I have no issue with using technology as what it is, namely a medium. That's what media means. It's something that comes between two people. Technology can be a medium as long as the end point of that is to bring two real people together. So for me, I think it's putting the priority back on real interpersonal encounter. The other thing for me, and look, I mean, I've said this so many times. I say this to everybody who asks me this. Read less short, emotive, sensationalist, outrageous stuff online. Spend less time online. Rediscover what moral encounters look like through the world of literature, through even the world of excellent television and films. That's the reason that I raised so many of the examples that I did in the course of the lecture, trying to whet people's appetite. My God, that's what it looks like for there to be a real transformative encounter between two people. Less time online, more time in that more patient medium, but also ultimately, isn't it obvious? More time with real people. Relearn the disciplines of transformative interaction. And for me, what's at the height of that, and I'll finish with this, is learning how to be silent again. Mm-hmm. Pregnant pauses, allowing there to be that interval between people, knowing when not to speak, that I think is one of the greatest of all the human graces.
Yes, you had a lovely line in that interview we did recently where you said justice is rarely served by haste or something like that. Mm. Yeah, that was great. Okay, Scott, all of your admittedly lovely stories of moral transformation and encounter with the other person happen in television programs, novels. Does it ever happen in, are you seeing it happening in real people's lives? I know that's a terrible question to ask someone about literature, but you know what I mean. Like, are you seeing good examples of this?
Absolutely. Look, the problem is, though, Simon, they happen, but they happen over time.
Yeah.
Because they happen over time, they can't be grasped. They can't be, they're not exciting. They can't be frozen at a moment in time and therefore conveyed meaningfully or a compelling way. Look, there's something that's very, very strange that's kind of happened to me. I guess over the course of the last 12 years when I've been kind of fairly intensely doing what I'm doing, I've come to describe one of the things that characterizes our lives today as the eventification of modern life. It does this because we no longer believe in religious calendars, in high holy days, and in moments that we set our spiritual clocks by. We move from, instead of Easter and or Lent and Easter and then ordinary time and then Advent and then Christmas, we move through another series of events Usually these events might be elections, or there might be climate change conferences, or there might be World Day of fill in the blank here. So much of our lives at the moment revolves around events, and it's the events that make all the difference. Whereas anybody who knows anything about social transformation, about movements for social justice, they know that events almost always mean nothing. I mean, they might be the culmination of something. They might be where all of these forces come together to raise a degree of awareness, but the hard work is done invisibly. The hard work is done in living rooms and on street corners, where places over extraordinary periods of time where nobody really notices. So the short answer to your question, Simon, is yes, these things are happening over a long period of time.
Yeah.
It's as two people know more and more about one another. And look, this is one of the other things. I think a lot about this. I'm really low on the ability of public debate to change minds. I just don't think someone watches an episode of Q&A or listens to something like this, and then suddenly the light comes on and they change their mind. They take a different way of thinking. Oh my goodness, that person just put forward such a wonderful argument. The way that minds change is from two people butting heads, and there's some small concession that's made in the heart of one or both of the people, some little inclination where they move a little bit closer together. And then the next time they speak, they're a little bit closer together still. And the next time, closer still. So it seems to me that because we're dealing with time, because we're dealing with silences and small concessions that allow us to save face, we don't have to do huge declarations of, my God, I was wrong. How could I ever have believed that? Because things take place over time, and because they're invisible, we think they don't happen. But that's the terrain within which moral encounter takes place, over time, often invisibly, and in ways that allow people to slowly come together and then find, almost waking up one day, how did we get this close?
Mm. Reminds me of the mustard seed, Scott, perhaps. Yeah. But there, look, there's a question, I think, related to this that I think is a really important one, which says simply this: all your examples of literary moral encounters were between close partners, married people. Can one have such moral encounters with offspring, for instance? And this is the bit that I think is really interesting. Does it require a certain kind of relationship that demands a kind of shared morality? You know, I might be... I've heard your lecture. I've changed my mind, actually, Scott, and I'm going to be more attentive. But the other person, sort of, what if they're not buying into this?
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily require shared morality. That's a point I think I really would want to stick with.
Mm-hmm.
I think it helps if the two of you have some kind of shared language.
Yeah.
I think the two of you do need to be in a position, ultimately, finally, where, to use that wonderful term that I used from John Stuart Mill, where you can both mutually look up to one another. One is not looking down on the other. One is not the teacher, but both are teachers of one another. I don't think it requires shared morality, but this is what it does require. It requires standing. It requires that both parties are in a position where they can recognize something fundamental in the other person that allows the other person to speak to them. That, I think, is what's so interesting about the example of Margaret Schlegel and Henry Wilcox from E.M. Forster's Howard's End. Yes, they're married, but they're also strangers to one another. Margaret develops over the course of their marriage to this incredibly overbearing man who doesn't see her as an equal in any way. She develops the standing, the ground on which she can stand and address her husband in this ferocious way that she does. Simon, one of the strange things about my job is I can spend all this time reading people with whose views I could not disagree more. I'd quite gladly spend the rest of my life opposing everything that they say they believe in. I've written ferociously in opposition to them and against them. And then I find myself in a studio with them, looking across the table at them. And there's something there that I can't deny. Yeah. Something in the intensity or the tenderness or the sensitivity that even though there seems to be this gulf between us, there is something between us that means that that person can address me and can address me fully. So I don't think there needs to be a shared morality. I really don't. I think there does have to be that moment where each party can say to themselves, this person has something that I am obliged to hear. This person has something that I can and must learn from. That, I think, is far more important than as, say, a shared moral universe.
Thank you. Okay. Sorry about this one, Scott. A number of us have been playing Scott Stevens bingo throughout the lecture. I'm still missing a reference to Hannah Arendt and a description of something being capacious. Can you help a sister out, Scott?
For those who have ears to hear, there was an awful lot of Hannah Arendt.
Is that all you got?
No. I'll just be brief, though. Capaciousness is one of Arendt's most wonderful ideas, but one of the things that she means, I mean, there are many things that she means by that, but one of, I think, the most beautiful things is that there is something fundamentally false about any human attempt to escape the air. She wrote her greatest book, The Human Condition, published it the year after Sputnik was launched into space. And she said that one of the things that's the launching of that satellite represented for many human beings is no longer having to be restricted to the confines of the Earth. They could escape one of these days. That limits, ordinary human limits, were things that could be transcended. She said that that is a fundamental rejection, a denial of what it is to be human. Because she said what it is to be human is not just to live within limits, but to cooperate together so that those limits don't become simply limits, but they become the occasion through which we learn to live together, speak together, find meaning together. For me, that's one of the most beautiful visions, I think, of life, that another human being isn't just an enemy. They're not just an impediment. They're not just a limit. Another human being is finally, ultimately, an invitation to discover forms of life, modes of friendship, forms of meaning that I never could have imagined otherwise.
That's lovely. Embracing the limits. I want two more, Scott. This person says, wonderful, Scott. I wonder, is it an absolute no to satire? What do you say to satire which motivates people to action, even attentiveness, for instance, the recent JobKeeper campaign, which raised an awareness and motivated people? Perhaps even the object of that satire to climate action, this kind of thing. Where does something like that fit? I mean, you had made that comment in the lecture.
Yeah. Look, for me, it's an absolute no to satire. I just despise it. I find it. Can I say this? Satire is left-wing hate speech. Let me put it as simply as that. Satire is to the left what many forms of racial bigotry or misogyny is to the right. They have the same structure, they have the same function. It involves speaking from a position of power to a position of powerlessness, or from a position of powerlessness to a position of power. Either way, it's envious over one group or one party having power and the other not having. The point of satire, like hate speech, is to bring parties to a position where one party can no longer be heard. What that satire does in the mode of laughter is the object of ridicule is in, or the object of satire is in a position to do one of two things, either laugh at themselves, after which they have to, by definition, lose face effectively, or if they complain, that's not fair, that's not a true representation, or that's not whatever, then they get ridiculed for not getting the joke. Either way, they get ridiculed. It's one of those things that pollutes, that toxifies the air. Now, there are forms of nearly vicious comedy that can so play up to or can so cast in a fairly extreme light a prevailing situation of inequality or, say, bureaucratic absurdity, or the contradiction of government policies, for instance. There are ways of doing that in a fairly extreme way that highlights what maybe people haven't been paying attention to. That, I think, is a perfectly wonderful, I mean, you think of something like someone like Jonathan Swift, that's precisely what he did. Think of Daniel Defoe, that's precisely what he did. Good comedy, I think, does that. What satire does is it laughs at the expense of another and it turns somebody else into an object of derision, whereby they are in no position other than to laugh at themselves and ultimately to put their tail between their legs. To my mind, it's just a corrupt form of speech.
Interesting. There's so many more things we want to ask, but we will leave it with this next last one, Scott. Could you comment on the potential for faith communities? Let's say we're a set of public Christianity, so let's say the Christian community, to be a source of something different from this sort of air of dismissiveness and contempt.
Yeah. Let me just say two things, and I really will keep it brief, Simon. I promise I don't want to wear out my welcome. The first thing is I think the time that is involved in any process of genuine religious observance is vital. It's very hard to hold lifelong grudges with people that you are going to see Friday after Friday or Saturday after Saturday or Sunday after Sunday. When you gather together in the same building, you end up praying together or you end up sharing together, you end up approaching the altar and receiving the Eucharist together. It's very, very difficult for there to be that kind of blood feud between you. I said at the beginning that there is no substitute for proximity. There's no substitute for presence. This is actually the reason, I know people are going to roll their eyes, this is the reason that I wanted to use the example of The Office and Pam and Jim reconciling wordlessly. To my mind, reconciliation is the most important thing. Proximity, people being together, coming together, living together is the most important thing. Sometimes that happens through the resolution of disagreements by verbally just having it out, getting to the bottom of things. But sometimes words are the impediment. And sometimes one of the greatest graces is just forgetting. You're just so used to seeing one another that you kind of forget what the big deal was about in the first place. So I think those habits, the physical habits of bringing us back together in the same space, instead of ghosting one another, instead of eluding one another, instead of avoiding one another, sniping at each other from a distance. Is there any way, is there any ability to place value on just the preciousness of forgetting what the grudge was all about and simply being used to being together with one another? So for me, that's one of the most important things, but this is the most important thing. Anyone who's listening carefully to, I really did talk a long time, didn't I? I'm really sorry about that. Anyone who was listening carefully would have noted the undertone or the theme of fear that ran throughout. We have become an unbelievably fearful people, an unbelievably fearful time. We don't want to have our minds changed. We don't want to lose what we have. We don't want to cede our positions of dominance. We don't want to give up the courage of our convictions or the concreteness of our convictions. And so we place walls. We refuse to reach out to other people. We don't want to be tainted by other people. We don't want to lose what we have. And so we erect barriers all around us. Jesus actually told a very important parable, I think, about exactly this. It's known to many of us as the parable of the tenants. A wealthy landowner gives three of his servants a certain sum of money and says to invest it, to do something good with it. This is also, by the way, is what's going on with the example of Bishop Muriel in Les Miserables. The purpose of consecrated things is to win the life of another, not just to be consecrated. So the wealthy landowner gives this sum of money to the three servants. One of them invests wildly, perhaps recklessly, and makes a ton of money. The master is thrilled. Another one invests a little bit more modestly, but still invests it, and the master is still very pleased. One of them is so fearful of losing the amount of money that he was given that he buries it. And the master is incensed. Didn't you realize that's not the purpose of the money that I gave? I think there's so much there about the character of the moral life. Nothing is lost by being patient with another person. Nothing is lost by being attentive to another person so that you discover what's maybe behind their seemingly prickly or edgy or intolerant edifice. There's nothing in lost in just lingering in the company of another person. There's nothing lost in forgiving another person. And yet we've convinced ourselves that if we give up too much, that ultimately we're going to lose what we have when we're terrified of it. For me, it's that fear that's corrupting the moral life of so many people today. Nothing is lost through generosity, through grace, through reconciliation. Nothing is lost through holding one's tongue and lingering with silence. Nothing is lost through patience. But to get to that point where we accept that nothing is lost, the first thing we need to renounce is fear. And quite frankly, I see contempt as a product, not of confidence, not of chest-beating self-assuredness, but ultimately of fear. Mm. Attentiveness is a life that renounces fear.
Mm. Well, Scott, that's a wonderful vision you've painted for us tonight. We're really grateful for it. We're looking forward to you being in the same room with us where we can have some proximity. And really, really pleased with tonight. We've loved having you do this lecture. So thank you so much. And thanks for the question time, which I think people have enjoyed as well. So thanks. Thank you. Thanks to our audience. Thanks for being with us tonight. We hope this has given you plenty to talk about in your groups and among your friends. We do hope you'll check us out at publicchristianity.org. Go to that and check it out. Also, perhaps sign up to our newsletter so you'll get news of our regular content. Turn to our podcast each week, Life and Faith. I think we can guarantee that you'll get some value from that and find that very engaging. And I'd also say keep an eye out for other events that we put on too, like our CPX conversations that we've been putting up on YouTube and on Facebook. We've got a good one coming up. Christine Kane will be talking about her organization, A21, which is an anti-slavery organization. It's a wonderful story that she tells. So look out for that one. You will get an email tomorrow in relation to the lecture tonight with the possibility to offer feedback. We'd love it if you do that. It won't take long and it really does help us plan future events. So thank you so much for being with us tonight. We'd love to see you in person sometime soon, but for now, it's good night.